Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. My guest on the show today is Peter Holzapfel. And if you missed the broadcast version of this interview, you missed me explaining or trying to explain why this band is so important to me. When I was in high school, I played in a band. The first band I played in, we rehearsed at this kid Isaac's house because his parents were away during the afternoons at work, and so we had free run of the basement. We had two amplifiers. There were seven of us, and all seven of us would plug into these two amplifiers. He also had a drawer in his kitchen full of Drake's cakes and Hostess products. So we'd eat this junk food. We'd listen to records. We'd go downstairs and we rehearse, and we didn't have very many songs, six or eight songs, and we rehearsed them three times a week for a few hours for months on end. And we were, in many ways, the best band I've ever been associated with. And some of us were 14 years old. I think the youngest were 14. And so we made up for our complete lack of skill and technique with energy and working at being good. And it was sort of an unlike any situation I've ever been in since then. But one of the things we did a lot was going upstairs and listen to records. And we listened to all kinds of records. I remember sort of listening to Kool & the Gang and wondering what we could sort of take from that. But we also listened to a lot of sort of more new wave, current, anything we heard on the radio. And a lot of the records came from people who would drop by and kind of visit our rehearsals, or older brothers who were bringing records back from college or trips to New York City. And when somebody brought back the DBs, it really, really changed the way I thought about how you could sing and the breadth of emotion and production you could bring to one record, but still keep it a catchy pop record. And it just really... really one of the huge bands for me were the DBs. So know that now as you listen to my chat here with Peter Holzapfel. And if you like this one, check out wfmu.org/Michael. There are archives of a previous chat I've had with Peter, as well as his partner in the DBs, Chris Stamey. I think there are live performance with Chris. Anyway, those archives are up on wfmu.org/Michael. Here's me and Peter. There's Nothing Is Wrong from the DBs, and as I mentioned earlier, I Thought You Want to Know, 1978 to 1981, comes out later this week, and Peter Holzapfel of the DBs joins us on the phone to, I don't know, give us some insight into this. Good morning, Peter. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. I finished my cereal, and I finished watching cartoons, and I'm ready to talk with you.
Terrific. Yes. Oh, I wish we could go back to those days. That was great. Just...
No kidding.
The DBs are a really important band to me. I've loved the whole career, and I've sort of followed as all the members have gone on to do other things and then come back together every once in a while. But those first two DBs records really changed my whole life, you know, and other folks as well. And to me, and so when I listen to this new collection, 23 early singles and demos and remixes, remasters, live recordings, it really brings this time to mind. So here's first question. To me, those early DBs, that period is like a giant step in music to me. And sometimes bands just move a giant step forward. They just find themselves way forward. And sometimes it's like a lot of links in a chain, and you can see a direct path of influences from, you know, point A to point B. Which is it for the DBs? Did you just somehow, you know, just blink into the future, or did you get there slowly?
No, I would say we definitely worked our way there. We had a very healthy scene in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where we all grew up. And we were surrounded by great musicians like Mitch Easter and the late Sam Moss, who showed us that what you have to do is you really have to learn the songs. You have to learn how to play them. And so we started with everybody else's songs and eventually got around to starting to write our songs somewhere around 1972. So by the time we got up to New York, we'd been writing songs for a while, and we'd been sort of working on our craft as musicians. And it was absolutely an exciting time. All those bands that we were friends with still are for the most part, but it was a really, again, went to another very healthy scene of bands. And that was, I think, nobody really looks at it as competition when you're doing it, but everybody, you know, that is looking for something to hook it on and says, oh yeah, everybody was competing. It just really wasn't. It was absolutely camaraderie up there. And when somebody got ahead, it was great. We were very happy for them. So that's exactly what we did. We came into the New York thing from North Carolina as wide-eyed Southern kids, but still pretty schooled musically. And, you know, Chris had gone to UNC in Chapel Hill and studied composition. So he's like serious, like classical music background. And, you know, he and Mitch had been recording also since we were teenagers. So they had been crafting that as well. And both have gone on to be fantastic producers and engineers. It was, I don't know why this all happened to us, but I'm really glad it did.
Would it have happened if you'd stayed in North Carolina?
Oh, you know, I wonder. I don't know. I have been thinking recently. I was born in Old Greenwich, Connecticut, and I often wonder what would have happened had I not gone with my family to Winston in 1962. But, you know, as far as staying in North Carolina, we just couldn't really do that. We tried. We did that through college, and we were getting nowhere. Mm. And after we left, obviously there were other bands that came up in our wake. And some of the guys we played with, like in the H-Bombs and Sneakers, started bands, and they did really well. And they were bands like the X-Teens and the Pressure Boys. And so everything, you know, any place where there's good music somewhere at some point will continue to have that because people are just surrounded by it. When we got to Chapel Hill, you know, there was no punk rock. We sort of did that, and that was nice. You know, Sneakers and the H-Bombs and a group called the Cigarettes. So, you know, we did what we could where we were as long as we could, and then we had to go. And that's why we ended up in New York.
Gotcha. Do you agree that that early DB's output is very different? It sort of brings together a lot of things that, to me, were sort of waiting to come together. And so that I think they really appealed to me because you had heard all the same records I heard, but you kind of smashed them together in a way nobody had done before. So do you agree with that? And can you put it into like, I think in the liner notes you mentioned Big Star. Can you give me a mathematical formula that equals the DBs with bands?
Good question. Well, you know, Beatles plus The Move plus The Kinks plus Big Star plus George Jones, plus George Coleman, Bongo Joe, plus Moondog, plus the Shags, plus everything we ever heard on the radio equals the DBs. You know, I mean, we are nothing if not, please pardon the pun, ardent listeners, and we always have been. I think about things when we were living in the basement apartment doing repercussion in London. We were listening to Tiddlywinks by NRBQ, and we were listening to What You're Proposing by Status Quo. And there was all sorts of weird stuff that we were listening to, and it was just great. And everybody listened to it. You know, we would just put it on and we would listen. So to me, that's one of the great parts of being in this band is everybody's expansive listening qualities and what that listening brings to the band, I think.
I think that's maybe you put your finger on it because, yeah, I agree. And maybe that is missing in some bands. Like their chain is a little bit shorter and that's not always bad, but it's part of what I think informs the DBs and makes that music to me have such a wide and interesting and maybe why we're still listening to it today. So you guys moved from North Carolina to New York City. Was there culture shock? What was your impression immediately of New York?
Well, I'd always wanted to live in New York. I was sort of a little bit irritated with my father for having moved us down to the South when I was six. And, you know, growing up, every Sunday we had the New York Times. And so I'd be laying on my stomach reading the arts and leisure section and looking at the ads for the Schaefer Festival and for the Fillmore and stuff and thinking, boy, I wish I was there, except I was, you know, nine. I wouldn't have been there anyway. But nonetheless, so Moving to New York seemed like a natural thing. When you grow up in North Carolina, if you go somewhere, mostly you either go to Atlanta or you go to New York or you stay in Winston-Salem. And so New York seemed like the place that we were going to go. And Chris went first, obviously, and came up and started playing with a group called the Erasers with the late Susan Springfield. And then he moved on and started playing bass with Alex Chilton, which was great because Chris was also the first guy who really sort of his antenna went up when he heard Big Star on the radio. And we actually heard it on local radio when it was new. That's how weird Winston-Salem was. So Chris goes up, and then he's followed by Gene, who was living in Philadelphia, and then by Will. And I came up a couple months later after sort of an aborted trip to Memphis. So I knew what I was in for. I can't speak for the other guys. I sort of knew that the energy that you have living in New York, and especially to me, the energy of being somebody in their early 20s living in New York, hand to mouth and hopeful and getting to see all these bands and trying to eat when record release parties would invite you and there would be an outlay of food there, you know, that sort of stuff. Working in a record store, which I got to do, you know, it was just the best time to be alive. And I think the enthusiasm of that time shows, especially in some of those early recordings. A lot of the stuff that we recorded at the New York Rocker offices, which were the demos that got us the deal for the first two albums proper, Stands for Decibels and Repercussion. But those demos, Nothing Is Wrong, perfect example. You know, we just cut those things on a four-track. Chris knew how to record them. Gene knew how to record them. Put the mics on. You know, I mean, we're using stacks of back issues of New York Rocker as like sort of sound barriers. But that's, you know, but you can make stuff happen. And it was so DIY at that point that there's a charming quality to those recordings that's still, you know, I still love hearing them today. That is my preferred version of Nothing Is Wrong, by the way.
Oh, that's interesting. New York can, you know, is famous for chewing you up and spitting you out. And with your tail between your legs, you go back to where you were. But it seems like you guys were embraced pretty quickly by audiences. How quickly were you embraced?
Pretty quickly. I mean, our first gig was a disaster. Well, first gig with me, that is. Chris and Will and Gene had been playing a bunch of stuff before I joined. And then we did this Halloween show at Irving Plaza with the Fleshtones and the Xantees and US Ape and the Cyclones, and we just flat out sucked. I don't know why. We just did. We weren't very good. There's actually pictures from backstage from after the show that somebody took, and we all look like somebody just shot our dog. So we went back to the music building and started rehearsing and rehearsing and rehearsing. Oh, wait, sorry. I wouldn't have been in the music building. We've still been rehearsing at New York Rocker. But we spent every night getting better and better and better. And then we came out and we opened a show for Nervous Rex, if you remember Nervous Rex, with Sean Brighton and Lauren Agnelli and the late Jonathan Gildersleeve. And we played really well. And then we started getting gigs again. But it took a little bit of, it was a little trial and error, I have to say. You know, Chris, like I said, Chris had established the band. They were looking for a keyboard player. That was what I, you know, it's essentially sort of like Graham Parsons joining the Birds as the piano player, you know. I mean, I sort of brought other stuff. So they were kindly receptive to the other stuff that I brought. And you know, we played a bunch. We played a lot of shows in New York. We played at Hurrah a lot. We played at CB's a lot. I sort of say my timing for New York is I came to New York 2 weeks after Television's last shows at the Bottom Line, which to me is sort of the, you know, I don't know if that's emblematic of the changing of the guards to the next generation of New York bands, but in some ways it is, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the other bands like the Ramones and the Talking Heads had burst onto the scene with actual records that actually charted and they actually toured and they got to, you know, go and get bigger. And we, you know, We tried. We didn't get much bigger than we got, but we had a good time doing it.
I mentioned earlier that one of the key elements of the DB's catalog is that the songwriting covers, you know, there's a pop base that everything's built on, but the emotion range is wider than most folks who start with a pop base, and there's a lot of melancholy. You mentioned sort of how the energy was so high being in New York City, but were you guys all feeling melancholy? Were you and Chris feeling melancholy? How was that balance?
Well, I'll say this kind of embarrassedly all these years later, but I was not a very good boyfriend in New York. And there's a long list of people who would agree with me. And, you know, it's taken me a long time to come to grips with that. But I think a lot of the melancholy that shows up in my lyrics is representative of my inability to know how to be a good boyfriend. And, you know, I look back on some of those words and I'm kind of aghast. But I see where they come from. I can't speak to Chris's very clearly because I think Chris is just a great wordsmith. You know, he really puts things together and removes parts that don't work and replaces them with parts that work better. I'm constantly in awe of his skill as a songwriter. So you would have to ask him specifically on that. But I think, you know, I don't think there's any sort of like, you know, homesickness particularly. I don't feel that in the DBs whatsoever. I think it's really just kind of emotionally romantic stuff that pops up lyrically for us.
Let me remind folks that Peter Holzapfel is our guest this morning, and thedbs.com is the website for info on the DBs and the new record, which is called I Thought You Wanted to Know, 1978-81, and it's a collection of 23 remastered early singles, demos, live recordings. It's coming out on the 15th on a 2-LP set and a single CD set. Does this title hint that there's more to come?
Maybe.
Okay. One key element of the DBs is that you and Chris both sing in full voice. I remember as a teenager putting the first couple records on the turntable, and to me the singing had a sort of an unguarded feeling to it, and you know, which really brought the emotion to the edge a little more than what most folks were doing at the time. You know, this is not a character singing the song. This is you guys, you know, singing your guts out. Do you agree? Do you think it was natural? Does it take guts to do that? And did it take some convincing or some confidence building to be able to stand up in front of a mic and sing that way?
I think this goes back to the thing about having had bands and played and learning how to do this stuff back when we were 14 and 15 years old. We were kind of thrown into the swimming pool and expected to swim, meaning that there are only a few kind of quality lead vocalists in Winston-Salem. We were sort of more of an instrumentalist town, if that doesn't sound too weird. But and then there are a few people that can really sing. Our bands, we didn't have that guy or that girl. We just had to sing. And, you know, same thing for Mitch and same thing for Chris and me. I mean, I sang for years in my church choir, you know, and I sang at school in choirs and stuff, but it didn't make me qualified to be a lead vocalist. And yet there I was, center stage, singing my heart out with my songs. I think I didn't know not to sing anything other than full on pedal to the metal. That's what I had to give. And there's a certain desperation to that that kind of fits with the lyrics that you were talking about. It's sort of like, help get me out of here. Is this over yet? I do love to sing now. I've sat out on my porch swing yesterday and grabbed a 12-string guitar, which I had just changed strings on. And you know how it is where you pick up a different instrument and it brings different songs out of it. And I was just sitting there and I was playing You Wear It Well by Rod Stewart, and I was playing Strangers by the Kinks, and, you know, it just, and I was singing.
and I wasn't very good, and I was probably an octave lower than I should have been. But I've gotten to the, you know, I wish in a lot of ways there was a way I could go back. The thing I would change about my performances over the years would be to try to enjoy the singing part of it more and not feel like it's just a cry for help from center stage. You know, I mean, I enjoy it a lot now. I've been doing these solo shows with a electric guitar, and I have really dug it, and I'm happy to sing now. But back in those days, I think it was a plea.
That's interesting. Well, in any case, it's very effective, and it's one of the things that I think inspired a lot of people to rethink their own musical. Because I think that in some ways, the DBs are a band's band. You know, everyone who heard the DBs started a band themselves with, you know, and
if you could patent that sentence, you would make a lot of money, Michael.
Yeah. But in this case,
unfortunately,
yeah, well, if you could get a royalty, you'd make a lot of money. So you mentioned that the band rehearsed a lot. You were motivated to rehearse a lot. And so tell me about, like, this, the songs that are on here. Tell me about the arrangement process. Somebody has a song, they bring it in, they play it on a guitar, everyone joins in. And how quickly did the kind of, because these arrangements often are very tight, very surprising. How did the rhythm section, how much juice did they have when it came to arranging, and how quickly did it all come together?
In our world, we have been known to make demo tapes of songs. Chris and myself and the rest of us at some point or another. So there may have been some individual action in that way. Not that either Chris or I can play drums very well. I mean, I'm playing drums, I believe, on the demo version of Dynamite on the record. I think that's the version that's on there. I haven't looked recently. You may have to cut this out. I like to play drums, but I'm not a very good drummer, and I am happy to put that into the hands of somebody as capable as Will Rigby. And, you know, Gene Holder is just a threat as a bass player. So
yeah.
I think in a lot of cases, we were able to come in, and it wasn't really like folk songs. We would kind of give them direction and give little, you know, rhythmic tattoos that we might want in a song. But for the most part, just kind of playing it a couple of times, it kind of worked. A lot of times would work itself out. And the singing, I think Chris, in a lot of cases, had specific notes he wanted me to sing, and I tried very hard to make that happen as confidently as I could within the parameters of crying for help. And so the stuff that you hear on those the rocker demos particularly are, they just fell together really easily. I think there's a nice thing that we had as four guys from Winston-Salem that already had grown up together, was the kind of an unspoken language, which also happened in the music. I think that there was something that we just felt that we could count on what the other person was bringing, because they also came from that Beatles plus the Move plus the Kinks plus Big Star, et cetera, formula, you know? And so we knew if we said, okay, this needs to sound like the solo on Evil by Spooky Tooth from Spooky 2. And it would be like, oh, okay, no problem. And it would sound just like that. So, you know,
gotcha.
Having
yeah.
that kind of shorthand was really helpful, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, to our detriment, of course, the concept has been suggested that the DBs might have broken up a year earlier had we thought to speak and call the meeting to do it. but we didn't. And we never really broke up anyway, you know? I mean, we've always stayed friends.
It's interesting that when these two records came out originally, they came out on a UK-based label. They did not come out in the U.S. originally at all, not until they were sort of re-released a decade or so after the original releases. And that's interesting because since then, they've been reissued on CD multiple times, and almost every permutation of the bands you guys were in has been before the DBs has come out, and there have been rarities. People are so interested in the archaeology behind the DB. So it makes me think when you were recording these records, moved from North Carolina to New York City, what were your expectations? Were you thinking we're going to have a hit record, or we just want some respect from people in New York City? What was your expectations?
I think that the DBs knowingly moved to New York with the intention of trying to make a record that could be played on the radio for the masses and would have some kind of universal appeal. Because we did not ever think that the songs that we were writing were eccentric or weird or anything other than kind of like what we listen to. Granted, that's Beatles plus Move plus Kinks plus Big Star and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know. You know, we had what we felt were absolutely reasonable expectations that we would be taken seriously as contenders to be on a major record label and put out a record to compete against the people who were on major record labels and putting out records. It didn't seem like it was that hard, but it was. And we didn't get to do that. The closest we came, I guess you would have to say, was Like This. And that was its own can of worms. And then The Sound of Music, and that was its can of worms. So it was never an easy process for the DBs and getting heard. We have to thank people like yourself and everybody who was a veteran of college radio in the late 70s through the early 90s who gave us, you know, airtime. They brought their copies of the records in because they weren't released in the U.S. And so people knew what Big Brown Eyes was. People knew what Amplifier was. You know, that's the most important thing. That was a great DIY aspect to the DB's existence, for which we are forever grateful. You know, I mean, that's how you did it then. And it's different now. But at least we can get these songs back out to people and we can see what they think of it now, 40 years down the pike, or whatever, 35 years.
It is amazing that there are bands like the DBs and like Big Star where someone has to hand it to you. You know, that's how it's one hand at a time, one guy at a party saying, you know, listen to this, you know, and it's amazing how wide things could spread that way. There is a song on this collection, I thought you wanted to know, 1978 to 1981, which was originally titled The Man Who Ate Too Many Lincoln Logs. And we're going to hear that song now.
Why? It's, I don't know.
Yeah, why? Was the lyrical content different, or was it just...
No. It's just I couldn't think of what to call it. I just didn't know what to call it, you know? Do you call it I Don't Enjoy You Anymore? That sounds like you could make that, you know, a diet ad. I have no idea. I have no idea why that came up, but that was on an early set list of like a master list of stuff that we found of all the stuff that we were doing. So,
well, eventually, common sense prevailed, and you called it Black and White. So, just tell me, writing this song, recording this song, this is a number one hit record, as far as I'm concerned. Do you look at it that way? Is it a high point for you? Is it a turning point as a writer? Do you love it?
Yeah, I do. I remember waking up and hearing Meg Griffin playing it as one of the singles that she was playing that week on her radio show, and just hearing it come out over the radio and just wanting to do cartwheels. Yeah, that's a kind of benchmark song for me, you know, and maybe also for the DBs, because I mean,
this has been Chris's band. Chris started the band. I was the late addition, and here I was with the A side of the single. So what's that about? And it muddied the waters a little bit as far as whatever the plan for the band was going to be. But, you know, it was also good. I still love that song. I still love that song. It's so much fun to play, you know. It's a great little riff. And thank you for your comments on that. Hey, I had one thing. I had one thing that I wanted to say in regard to what we were talking about before. In some ways, it should be no surprise to me that the DB's career paralleled a lot of the careers of the bands that we really loved. You know, I don't think we went into this thinking we were going to become collector's items. We wanted to be, you know, the record you found in Goodwill after 20 years.
Right.
You know, but we're happy with the, you know, we love our fans and we're so grateful that they're stuck with us for so long.
We're going to hear this mix of black and white that's on this new record. Tell me what exactly we're listening to here.
This was done the day that Don Dixon and I helped Mitch put the glass into the drive-in studio window between the room and the mixing room where the console and the speakers were. So Dixon, we got the glass up, and Dixon was just threw up some tape, and it was black and white, and he did this really streamlined mix, and it was, I just assumed it was lost for years, and I guess it was, and somehow or other, here it is. And it's just, it's so different from the one on the other record. I think people will appreciate that. And it has that little Don Dixon touch to it, which is always welcome.
Yeah. Thank you, Peter Holzapfel. The new album, it's a 2-LP set or on a CD, comes out the 15th. I thought you wanted to know. Check out thedbs.com for information, and I hope this is the first of many.
Keep your eyes open, Michael. That's all I can tell you. Thanks for having me on your show, and thanks, everybody, and I hope you all enjoy the new record.